to VBAC Birth Stories, a podcast where Australians share their journey to a vaginal birth after cesarean.
We are a safe haven for women to share their own VBAC journeys and through these personal experiences, educate and empower listeners.
I'm your host, Mel.
And I'm your host, Steph. And this is VBAC Birth Stories.
Hi everyone, today Steph and I hear from Erin, who lives in Perth with her husband and two children. Erin is a type 1 diabetic and we hear how this affected her first pregnancy and what different approaches she took in her VBAC pregnancy to give herself the best chance of experiencing spontaneous labour for the first time, as she was induced in her first birth, which is a common practice with type 1 diabetic mothers. Erin tested positive to group B strep towards the end of her VBAC pregnancy, which also coincided with a snap lockdown in Perth due to COVID. In maternity, this took the form of support people being disallowed from entering the birth suite in public hospital settings until the mother was deemed to be in active labour. On the day Erin's labour began, restrictions had been lifted and residents of Perth were able to go to football matches as well as the pub, but not maternity. Her husband missed out on supporting her during the crucial early stages of labour and was also asked to leave 15 minutes after her daughter was born via a repeat emergency cesarean. Despite how COVID affected her labour, a resilient Erin came away from her birth with overall positive feelings about the experience, which she attributes to the kind of preparation she had done in her second pregnancy. Erin, we thank you so much for coming on this platform and sharing your story. We encourage government and hospital policymakers to listen and learn from Erin's experience. We need to get the balance right because, as anyone who listens to our podcast would know, support in birth matters and no woman should ever have to labour alone. Please enjoy this episode of VBAC Birth Stories.
Thanks for sharing your stories with us today, Erin. Did you want to start just by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. My name is Erin. I live in the inner suburbs of Perth, WA, and I live with my husband, Josh, our son, Kaya, who turned 3 last week, and Neve, who is 4 weeks old.
Tell us what were your preconceived, I guess, thoughts or ideas about childbirth before you fell pregnant for the first time, and what do you think sort of shaped them?
I think that I always had a bit of a romanticised notion about being pregnant and having a baby based on movies. I think I also thought, like a lot of women do, that the birth would just be one day that I have to get through, that I knew would be painful, that I'd be laying on my back and screaming and it wouldn't be great, but I just have to get through it because that's what you need to do at the end of a pregnancy. Before my first pregnancy, I hadn't really exposed myself to any birth stories. I think if women told me their birth story, I probably didn't really listen anywhere near the way I would have listened for being pregnant the second time. So yeah, I didn't have a strong understanding at all the first time.
Did you want to take us back to your first pregnancy, how you came to fall pregnant and how that first pregnancy was for you?
Falling pregnant with Kai happened very quickly and easily, and it was an absolute delight to learn that we were pregnant. And quickly I made myself an appointment to get into the high-risk public hospital because I have type 1 diabetes. So it's an autoimmune condition that I've had personally since I was 9 years old. It used to be called juvenile diabetes because it was usually children that got it, but the last couple of decades people have been getting it in their late teens and, you know, throughout adulthood. So it's now called just type 1 diabetes, and it means that my immune system is activated to destroy the cells in my pancreas that produce insulin. And insulin is necessary to break down food that turns it into energy. So if your body isn't producing insulin, your blood sugars go very high, which can make you very, very unwell. And you need insulin therapy. You can't just control it with medicine or with food like you can do with type 2 diabetes and gestational. So that means I have insulin. I use an insulin pump to give me that insulin. But unfortunately, you can't just plug it in and go for it. You then have to be a mathematician to work out how much you need per hour, how much you need per day, how much you need per portion of carbohydrate. And then other things can affect it, like your hormones. Obviously, pregnancy can affect it hugely. Stress, the weather, exercise, all impact your blood sugars. So it's a disease that you constantly think about and is constantly impacted, and it can put a lot of stress on people. But for me, being pregnant both times has been weirdly the easiest time of my diabetic journey because I have the technology. It's free when you're pregnant, the constant glucose monitoring that tells you what your blood sugar is, and it alerts you when you're going low and high, which is very handy in the night when you're driving. I had the best control of my life of diabetes because I had the biggest motivator, another human that I was caring for. It wasn't just about me anymore. It was about a little person that I wanted to do everything that I possibly could to make sure that the baby was healthy. I put so much effort into it. I got great results. And now, even not being pregnant, a few weeks later, I'm already being like, oh, I've got, you know, the baby on the boob, and I've realized I've forgotten to have insulin. I'm like, oh, well.
Yeah, it must be hard. Are the measures the same that as gestational diabetes, or is it different numbers that you're adhering to with type 1?
Yeah, similar. So for me, I try and keep my blood sugars, we're not pregnant, under between 4 and 10. And if I get above 10, I'm like, oh, I better have some insulin. Why am I 10? When pregnant, I kept them tighter. So between 4 and 6 was the goal, and I'd correct if I got to 8. But I think with gestational, I'm not 100% sure, but I know that sitting at 7 or 8 can be problematic.
I think that rings a bell. Yes.
Yeah. The cutoffs as well for being diagnosed with gestational are quite strict as well. But it does impact your body and your life in a similar way that gestational does, because you have to watch what you're eating and you have to keep your blood sugars in range to ensure a healthy pregnancy. I always thought that falling pregnant would be hard with having diabetes, but the falling pregnant part isn't hard if you have somewhat well controlled. But the moment you're pregnant, you have to, as a diabetic, make sure that your blood sugars are as well controlled as possible. So I went to the public hospital pretty quickly, joined up with their clinic program for high risk for type 1. Yeah, I really enjoyed being pregnant with Kai. I ate really well, did Pilates. I didn't have any of the typical pregnancy symptoms that women can struggle with. I was really lucky like that. So if it wasn't for the diabetes, that probably would have been like an absolute dream pregnancy, to be honest. So for the first few months, everything went by swimmingly. I did always have slightly high blood pressure, like slightly high, not enough for medication, but just enough to be like, oh, it's a bit high. And towards the end, so at about 7-8 months pregnant, I was going to a lot of appointments. So with diabetes, it ends up being, I think I had 8 ultrasounds in total.
Wow.
And yeah, which is nice, you get to see the baby, but it means that there's so much data being produced that they notice any small thing and therefore react to it. And the same with blood pressure and the same with urine tests. So anything tiny, they get you back in and have further tests. Towards the end, that was happening. I was having frequent hospital visits to the clinic, became weekly, and I did pick up when I was about 35, 36 weeks that my blood pressure was a little bit more elevated and my feet had started to swell a little bit. And I only learned this in my second pregnancy, actually, that my liver function wasn't perfect. So I remember being in the doctor obstetrician's office. I didn't have continuity of care with obstetricians or midwives, which is really unfortunate for type 1 because that would be really beneficial. So I saw a doctor that I'd seen maybe once or twice, and he said, let's get you in induced next week at 37 weeks. And I just kind of agreed because I thought, yep, that sounds good. I agreed to it without really thinking about it, without really talking to other people about it.
And so his reasoning was, let's get you in for an induction just because you're high risk because of the type 1 diabetes.
Yeah, so with type 1, babies can get big quite quick. It's called macroplasmia.
Yeah.
And Kai, my first baby, was measuring slightly big throughout the whole pregnancy. But I got the reassurance from all the doctors and midwives because I'm quite tall and not that small, and my husband's very tall. Everyone in my family, we're not small people. So they just said, you know, that's, you know, some women have big babies. But I noticed towards the end, the last few weeks, there was a lot of talk of big baby, diabetic baby, and that increases the chances of
shoulder dystocia.
Shoulder dysplasia.
Blood sugar. Did you say also that your blood pressure?
Yeah, blood pressure was high as well.
It was a little bit high. Was that also kind of the factor for your obstetrician to recommend induction as well?
Yeah, I do know now that it is highly recommended, especially at this particular hospital. They do like to induce diabetic mothers between 37 and 38 weeks. And in the last 3 years, I think they're actually pushing more for 38 weeks. But yeah, 3 years ago, 37 was very normal, just with diabetes alone. And I feel as though if I would have challenged the 37 weeks based on what I do know now, they would have then said, well, your blood pressure's a bit high, your feet are a bit swollen, and your liver function's not great. So I'm sure that they could have probably convinced me even if I challenged it a little bit. Yeah, but I do know that diabetics very, very rarely get past 38 weeks just with the diabetes alone.
So did you end up going in and then at 37 weeks for an induction?
Yeah, so I didn't know anything about what an induction meant. Like, I did a quick Google of what.
Yeah.
And I think I even expected to have the baby that day. Like, it was, I remember it was the 16th of May, and I told people, like, yep, 16th of May, we're having the baby. And we actually showed up at the hospital, and there was no record of me coming in that day. So they sent us away. Josh and I went to the pub for a bit, you know, his last beer before becoming a dad, and I put my swollen feet up, and then we headed back to the hospital a few hours later thinking, we're having the baby tonight. Got there, they were, you know, able to accept us at that time, and then went to a room where the induction process started. I had the Cetaphil, is that how you say it?
Yeah. Cervidil.
Yeah. Cervidil. That's it. Yeah.
Cervidil. So you had the gel?
Yeah. And the tampon one inserted. And it was left in overnight and nothing had happened. Like, I had some very minor, like Braxton Hicks like contractions. Josh went home and in the morning, nothing had happened. They did a cervical examination, which I remember absolutely hating, and nothing, I wasn't dilated. I was still very hard and high. And then I think they did it again or left it in for a few more hours and nothing was happening still. And then I think by that time it was nighttime, so they gave me some sleeping tablets to get through the night. And then in the morning I remember an obstetrician coming in and just saying, still, your cervix is not ripe at all, you're unfavourable, and offered me a C-section. I think I didn't really need to think about it for very long. I think, looking back, I'd kind of convinced myself, because so many type 1 diabetics end in a C-section or inductions end in a C-section, that I'd have a C-section anyway. So I accepted it quite easily. I don't remember being really upset or anything.
Did you know anyone that had natural births with type 1 diabetes at all?
No one personally, but there's this Facebook page, and if anyone's listening now who's a type 1 diabetic, there's a Facebook page called, maybe I won't put it out right now, but it's a great Facebook page. it's called Birth and Beyond or something with type 1 diabetes, and it's one of the best resources. So yeah. I did searches on there all the time, and whenever I got back from a hospital appointment, I'd type in C-section 37 weeks and, or, you know, induction 37 weeks, and find information. So I kind of read about people on a Facebook page, but I didn't talk to anyone personally.
Sure. Okay. We can reference that page in the show notes. So okay. Yeah, for our listeners.
Right.
That's good to hear. Okay. Sorry. So you were up to, I suppose, the cesarean, being told that that's your really sort of option. Do you want to take us from there?
Sure. Yeah. I feel like this is more memorable than the lead up, to be honest. But they scheduled me in for a very early epidural. And it was awful. The person that did it, the anaesthetist that came in, he was due to go home after doing this epidural. He'd been there for how many days doing, you know, long 12-hour days, whatever doctors do. And he missed three times in a row. And so I ended up passing out after a while. I think I was holding my breath. I hadn't learned any breathing techniques that time. So I think I just sat there holding my breath, waiting it to be over. But because it took so long, I ended up passing out. That wasn't a very nice start. And then I remember going into the room and getting prepped, and I remember that being somewhat positive. And this is the awful bit that people get a bit shocked by when I tell them this. The epidural, about 20 minutes into the procedure, I felt intense pain. And I remember yelling out, like, this hurts. And the anaesthetist or one of the doctors said, yes, you're supposed to feel, you know, moving and tugging like someone's doing the washing up in your stomach. So my heart rate climbed and, yeah, I could feel what was happening. So it turns out that
more than just a tug or a pull.
It was more than a tug. It was awful. Like, I feel shivery now thinking about it. I feel like I'll never forget the way that pain felt. It's a pain I've never felt before. Luckily, it was very, very quick because the anaesthetist would have upped the medication, upped the epidural. Everyone dropped what they were doing and moved away from me while they were doing that. And then they continued. So that kind of left me thinking, oh my God, I never want that to happen again, that feeling of pain. And it's very, very, very rare that that happens. Like, I haven't spoken to anyone else that has experienced that. So they must have just got the numbers, the measurements wrong for what my body needed, or not tested it properly. Actually, because I ended up meeting with anaesthetist.
Yeah, I thought you were doing well with that, because I always struggle with it.
I can never spell it either. I'm like,
anaesthetist.
And spell check, can't even solve it. They're like, I've got no idea what you're trying to write. So I met with
guy.
The dude that does the drugs.
The dude that does the drugs.
I met with him before having my second baby just to go through everything, because I'm like, what happened? What can we do to prevent that this time if I have a C-section? So he drew me a diagram on the back of a bit of paperwork, as doctors do, trying to explain things, that the layers of my body, wasn't able to reach a certain layer. So when they cut to that layer, I could feel it. That was awful. But yeah, next thing. And then I think not too long after, Kai was brought out of my belly. And I remember seeing him, his arms and legs stretched out, and me just asking, is he okay? I'm like, yep, he's beautiful. He's okay. He got, you know, measured quickly. I think he was in my arms pretty quickly, because I said I really want some skin on skin, want to breastfeed quite quickly. I told them that going into the C-section, that was important to me. That was pretty much the only thing I knew that I wanted from my birth experience, if I had a C-section. And yeah, he was on me very quickly, and he did the crawl up to my breast and latched on really easily. I think it took a while for them to stitch me up. I think there was like some issue. I'm not sure what it was. It took a bit longer, but I was distracted by this beautiful baby, little baby Kai on my chest. And then, yeah, went to recovery. And so I got given Tremadol. And I think that, and maybe the drugs that I was given during the C-section when they were upped because of feeling it, I couldn't walk for days. I was stuck in the hospital bed for, I think, 4 days after giving birth, which led to getting bed sores, which led to me not having a shower for days. Mm-hmm. And then I had an adverse reaction to Tremadol. So it made me not be able to move, and I hallucinated from Tremadol as well.
I've heard of it.
I remember my dad standing at the end of the bed, and I thought that we're on a ship and that he was the captain of the ship. I remember that. And that, I think after that, I was like, I don't want to take that anymore. Just spent the next few days in hospital with him, and Josh was there with us helping.
In terms of bonding with Kai when he was born, how did you feel that went?
I didn't have that rush of love. I felt like I would have thrown myself in front of a bus for him, because he came from me and he was mine, but I didn't have a rush of absolute love for him like people describe. That was one of the reasons that I think I really wanted to be back. I wanted those hormones. I really wanted to experience it.
Did Kai stay with you in recovery as well? Like, it's really good. You did get that skin to skin in theatre and a breastfeed, isn't it? That's great.
Yeah, and my husband got skin on skin in recovery as well, and back in the hospital room. So whenever they were doing tests on me or anything, he went to Josh. His blood sugar has to get checked after the first feed to make sure that his blood sugar's not low. That's quite common with type 1, and I assume with gestational diabetes as well. And his blood sugar was perfect, which is great. So he never had to be taken away from me or given the gel or anything. So I don't remember us being separated or having that feeling of give me back my baby, you know.
And did you feel as though breastfeeding was a positive experience and that it was going well?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it wasn't as easy as you think it's going to be if you don't know how much women can struggle with it. I remember going to a class at the hospital that was really handy. He did have some troubles, some issues latching on, and I did go to the lactation clinic at the hospital. That was also quite useful. I think also being born at 37 weeks made it a bit harder for him. So as he got to be closer to, like, you know, 3-4 weeks old, it just kind of all fell in place, and we had a beautiful breastfeeding journey. I fed him until he was 19 months old, and we were both kind of ready, I think. And I love breastfeeding, loving doing it now as well.
Oh, that's great. At this point, did you think to yourself, I don't want to go through that again? Or were you thinking at all about subsequent pregnancies, VBACs?
I think from that moment until I was about 3 or 4 months pregnant, I was like, just take me in for a C-section.
Wow.
To avoid that induction process.
Yes.
And make sure I get the right drugs this time and just take me in. And I'd heard a lot of positive booked cesareans as well that my friends had.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, well, I had a cesarean, but, you know, this went wrong. I was in hospital for days. I wonder if I could just have the cesarean and everything else be positive surrounding it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't actually until I started listening to positive birth stories and started realizing how even going into labor or even experiencing a bit of labor could, you know, get all those hormones running, and it could really change my birth experience. And I realized it was something that I didn't want to miss out on. And even though it might not end this, you know, perfect VBAC scenario, I really, really wanted to give it a go.
Did the doctors actually tell you anything when you were discharged from the hospital with regards to future pregnancies? Did they give you any advice at all?
No, I don't remember anything. If it was said, maybe I brushed it aside and just said, yeah, I'll worry about that later. Yeah, no, zero recollection of any conversation about that.
When you went into your pregnancy with Neve, did you go down the same path, the same model of care with the public hospital and the high-risk clinic? Did you change any of that? Was that all the same as last time?
Very similar. What I did differently this time was I went to that. They've got a preconception clinic where you can actually sign up for a subsidy for the CGM, again, the constant glucose monitoring system. You can apply for it for 6 months and then have it for up to a year. But that care includes going to a clinic and seeing a dietitian and getting your HbA1c done. And once it gets into a good range, they don't say, yes, you can go make a baby now, but they say, yeah, this is a safe, healthy zone for you to fall pregnant. So I took advantage of that care and really enjoyed it. Then when I fell pregnant, which was the first month that we tried, went back to the clinic and started the same model of care, which I enjoyed. Like, it's a nice clinic, but it's also, now I realise how much more beneficial it is to have continual care and seeing the same doctor or the same midwife every week, how much better that would have been for me and how much better it is for women in general. So I decided to get a student midwife through one of the universities in Perth, and that was one of the best choices I made. I think I learned about it through the Australian Birth Stories podcast. They spoke to someone about making a birth map instead of a birth plan.
We did a bonus episode on birth mapping.
Did you?
I don't know if you'd listened.
No, I think it was you. And I ended up getting really into that concept because I found it really hard to do like a step-by-step plan because of so many different variables. And, yeah, she sat with me and really helped me work out, well, if this happens, this could happen. If this happens, you'll need to decide this. So let's learn what this is. So she really helped me mentally prepare for all the different things that could happen and how to make good choices that I felt empowered by.
And when did you feel that you were shifting towards VBAC? So you were saying you were listening to stories. Did you express this to your care providers?
Yes. So when I was about 8-9 weeks pregnant, I think I started to shift from just wanting a C-section to thinking, no, I want to get further than 37 weeks this time if everything is healthy, if everyone's healthy. I want to get to 39 weeks. I felt like that was a good middle ground for me. And my pregnancy, last pregnancy, was, you know, was pretty healthy. There's no other issues with my body except for what happened at the end. I prepared like all these notes on research that's been done in other parts of Australia and overseas, especially in Canada and America, about how type ones now are getting to 39, 40 weeks, or, you know, going past 40 weeks, and how that's okay if the woman has really well controlled diabetes and no other health issues. I'm not saying every diabetic should you know, go to 41 weeks. But I did become very aware that I didn't have to agree to 37, 38 weeks. And so then I made a decision that either I wanted a C-section or I wanted to go into spontaneous labor. And I started really focusing on my body going into spontaneous labor and how amazing that would be and how I would do everything in my power to allow that to happen as long as, you know, the baby and myself were healthy. So that was my new goal from about 6 months pregnant, I think. That shift happened from listening to positive stories.
That really sounds similar. You know, type 1 diabetes, you know, you've discovered that you can continue your pregnancy for a little bit longer than that recommended induction phase. And it's similar to like even gestational diabetes.
Yeah.
We're also told you'd be having your baby before 40 weeks. In actuality, you know, talk to certain different doctors, different midwives, they're actually saying, well, if your blood sugar levels are well controlled, we don't see a reason we need to evacuate the baby by a certain time. It's similar, right?
Like everyone's health is different. Everyone's diabetes is different. And it just seems bizarre to me that doctors are like, diabetes, gestational diabetes, 38 weeks. And that's the blanket rule. Also with technology these days, like my diabetes is so well controlled compared to what it was even 3 years ago with my first pregnancy. And I don't feel like they're making allowances for how similar my control is to a non-diabetic. So really what's the difference?
Did uterine rupture worry you at any point during your VBAC pregnancy?
No. And I could have let it worry me, but I just decided not to because I felt like the risk was so small. And if you want to start listing all the risks, like driving to a hospital, you know, that's a risk, then I would have been overwhelmed. So even though I discussed it with the doctor when he brought it up and I asked what I thought were the right questions, like what are the chances? What do you do if you can see that it's happening? What happens if it does happen? What's the worst case scenario? So I feel like I educated myself on it and then just kind of boxed it away and put it to the side because I wasn't going to let it change my mind.
Sure, yeah. So Erin, what else did you do in your pregnancy once you decided that 6 months, you know, down the track that this is kind of the path you'd like to go down, that VBAC was on your radar? What else did you do? Did you do any courses? Did you do anything else that was physical, like seeing a chiro, acupuncturist, anything like that?
Yeah, I did a lot more this time. Last pregnancy, I did Pilates. This time I did Pilates as well. And I did start doing a pregnancy friendly one towards the end. I wanted to do hypnobirthing, but I couldn't quite commit. And I feel like I'd recommend it to people even without doing it. but I ended up doing a yoga course that was just on, not a course. It was a 1 day session that I did with another friend of mine and her partner who having a baby soon. So it was more of a social thing. And they did a lot of breathing techniques and massage and also went through a lot of birth information. I think was great for our partners to listen to. Yeah, that was like my version of hypnobirthing. I also did acupuncture twice, 38 weeks. And then I went the day before I was 39 weeks. Because I wanted the spontaneous labor, I did all the things. I had pineapple, I had the raspberry leaf tea. I bought dates, but I hate dates, so I did not eat them. And this other thing, they're disgusting. What else did I do? Oh, that's right. So a friend of mine went into spontaneous labor after having this apparently famous eggplant parmigiana. I don't know if you've heard of it.
My family actually makes that.
No way.
Yeah, so that's like a family recipe.
I didn't know about it because most people are like, what now?
How did COVID coincide with this pregnancy?
So throughout my actual pregnancy, it didn't really affect me that much. I think we had one lockdown in January, but that was, you know, just stayed home, didn't really affect me. I think I went in for one appointment where I wore a face mask. And then things changed about a week before. When I was 38 weeks, there was a community case and there was a suspected local community transmission. So we went into a 3 or 4 day lockdown over the Anzac Day weekend. And I was planning on getting some stretch and sweeps over that weekend because my induction was booked for Wednesday, the 29th of April. So, yeah, it was really challenging because I knew that if I went into labor, like I was trying to go into labor in the 38th week, that was where I really wanted, the 38th week before my induction. If I knew if I went to labor, then there'll be restrictions in place and that my husband wouldn't be allowed in, that I wouldn't be allowed an extra support person, that Josh would have to leave. So I just put it out there in the world that I wanted to go into labor on the Tuesday before my induction. And I'm not a moon or star sign kind of person, but I did run into a woman from my Pilates class who said, all you need is a full moon and you're going to labor. I'm like, okay. Anyway, it was a full moon. Tuesday was the full moon, the pink moon. And I remember going outside after having my Parmigiana, after eating lots of pineapple, raspberry leaf tea, going for a long walk, doing the, you know, just ticking things off that list, going to acupuncture, which I love, by the way, I recommend that to everyone. I went out to the moon. I was like, yes, tonight, let's, you know, come on, baby. That was me. That was me thinking that if I went into labor from that day forth, then there wouldn't be COVID restrictions in place. Like, we might have to wear face masks in the waiting room, but I thought things had been lifted because the lockdown had finished and the football was on and you could go to the pub and you go to a friend's house. So I really thought that everything would be sweet. Anyway, I laid in bed that night. We watched Talladega Nights. I got the biggest, carbiest burger I think I've ever consumed. For some reason, I just felt like I needed carbs and somehow my blood sugar stayed stable because I was so good at counting carbs at that point. And I started having really full-on what I thought was Braxton Hicks contractions, but I'd had them the night before and they disappeared. So I didn't really get too, you know, excited or overthinking or Googling like you do when you have any kind of labor symptom. They kept going and I remember laying down and being like, right, I need to get some sleep. You know, it's 11 o'clock and Talladega Nights is finished and had the best burger ever. And the contractions kept going. I think about a minute after I'd laid down, I felt that pop.
Oh,
yes. I was like, no way. And only because I'd actually researched this time, I knew what was going on. And I sat up and I had that gush that happens in the movies, the just like between my legs, water everywhere. And I was like, oh my God, it's happening on the day that I put it out in the world that I wanted to go into labor. Like, I don't have to be induced. This is the best. Yes. And I was, yes, so excited. Like, I feel tingly now thinking about how excited I was sitting up in bed and just being like, this is happening. Like, waking up my husband, who I think had just fallen asleep. I got in the shower because I was like, yeah, showers, labor shower. I love showers. Got in the shower to feel clean and freshened. And then, oh, I completely forgot. I tested positive for group B strep, which is actually a big part of this birth story.
I was going to ask you, is you had an induction date booked in, right? Did you feel pressure to induce during the end stages of pregnancy?
Yes. They encouraged me for me to book an induction date at 39 weeks. They wanted to do 38 weeks just to be safe. And they gave me the scary birth stories. And one doctor in particular kept telling me these horror stories. And I'm like, I actually said to him once, I'm like, do you think that's going to change my opinion? You need to stop. I said, you need to stop telling me these stories. Every woman is aware that childbirth is a risky business and that sometimes things go wrong. You don't actually need to remind me of that every week. I told him I need to hear positivity because this is a choice I've made to get to 39 weeks and that's what's happening. You're not going to change my mind, so please stop. And he respected that and stopped telling me those stories. Yeah, I think I was comfortable with 39. I felt like 40 weeks being a type one was maybe just pushing it a little bit. And I think based on everything I'd read, I think 39 was like a good compromise. It was a nice sweet spot. It was going to give my body some time to go into spontaneous labor. And I was really hopeful, even though I know it's the baby's decision on when that happens. I did consider sometimes being like, can I have a few extra days, especially with COVID and the lockdowns, if that was going to continue. I was considering just, you know, not showing up, just negotiating a few more days.
And so you tested positive for GBS?
Yep. And I don't remember having a conversation with a midwife who gave me the test about what the implications were if I tested positive and about whether I had a choice or even talk to me about what happens to babies that are birthed with the mother having group B strep in their system at the time. And I probably, would recommend to women to do a bit of research on that because it was something that I didn't do. It kind of missed my to-do list. So I tested positive, didn't think too much of it, but did then learn that if my waters broke, that I would need to go to hospital quite quickly to be on the antibiotics. So with type one, they encouraged me to go into the hospital sooner rather than later anyway. So I'd already accepted that I wouldn't be one of those women that spends the day at home laboring in the bath or going for a walk or playing with the kids and watching movies. So I'd already accepted that, which I guess didn't make me look too much into the implications of testing positive.
So did that mean that you had to have antibiotic administered through a drip during the second labour?
Yeah. So what happened leading up to that? So my mother came over to look after our toddler who was asleep, and we drove to hospital and I was getting quite regular contractions, and I could see that beautiful pink moon, feeling really positive and excited. And I even like did some short filming of the lead up, what was happening in the car and the conversations we were having, and then walking into the hospital. As we got to the entrance of the hospital, there were some security guards there. And I was like, well, that's normal because, you know, it's a hospital and we probably have to check in for COVID, and maybe they check that we're wearing our masks, which we were. And walked in and I said, I'm in labour. I called ahead to make sure that, you know, I'm doing the right thing. Let's go inside. And they said, oh, no, he can't come, to my husband. And I remember feeling like, yeah, of course he can. I'm in labour. We're at hospital. It's happening. Of course he can come in. And they said, oh, we'll just call. Yeah, good call. Yeah, just make sure that, yeah, of course he can come in. And then, yeah, a minute or so later, they came back and said, no, you can only come in if you're in active labour. And I feel like my body just kind of shut down at that point. Like everything I had imagined, all the options that I'd considered, I never thought that would be something that I'd have to do, was to go to hospital by myself and in labour and be in labour by myself. So that was, oh, I feel emotional talking about that moment in time. It was awful.
Your husband could only join you in hospital if you were in established active labour, or yes. He just couldn't join?
He couldn't be with me. Well, he was sent to the car where he sat while I got checked to see if I had, how dilated I was, and I wasn't dilated at all. So he went home and I went up to the MAFAL unit and I was in a small room. And I was, connected to the drip for group B strep, and I was connected to the monitoring bands, and I sat there all night. This is from midnight until the morning by myself. And, of course, my contractions, they kind of came to a stop for a while there, and then they kind of came randomly throughout the night. So they were too intense to sleep, but not intense enough to think that anything was actually happening. And I requested a birthing ball so at least I could sit up and try and get the baby moving in the right way, try and get everything going. That took a while. I asked if I could walk around the ward, and I think they let me go once they disconnected the drip. But they insisted that I was connected to the monitoring that whole night, and the midwives were coming in doing observations regularly. So it was a really disruptive night in a confined space, thinking I've just gone into spontaneous labour, which is all I ever wanted, and now I'm just here by myself. So it wasn't traumatizing, but it was pretty awful. It's not what should have happened.
Prior to arriving at the hospital, had anyone told you that you would be only allowed to be admitted on your own?
No. I never knew, based on asking numerous people and going on the hospital website and asking midwives that I know, I was never informed that partners weren't allowed in until their partner was in active labour. So even when I called that night and said, I've got diabetes, I've got group B strep, is it smart to come in? Can I stay at home? I wasn't even told then that I'd have to go in by myself.
Okay. So if you had been dilated by a certain amount, then they would have allowed someone to come in, but because you weren't, they wouldn't allow anyone to come in, and you weren't given the option to go back home. Like you had to sort of stay because of all of the high risk factors with you. That was why you had to stay as well.
Yes. Yeah. So if it wasn't for those high risk factors, I probably would have been like, well, I'm going home. What saddens me the most is I'll never know that if I could have given birth hours after arriving at hospital, if my body was sent the positive messages, if the right, you know, the right chemicals and hormones were released, but instead cortisol would have, you know, spiked. I really would have really spiked and prevented my body doing what it really was meant to be doing. And if I was able to stay home as well, and then you know, gone back, it could have been a very different outcome. I think that's the one part of my whole birth story and how it was affected by COVID, how that, I don't think I'll, yeah, I'm still not over that. I'm still not accepting that that was what happened. The whole thing, what happened for women that week giving birth in Perth, at that hospital in particular, was that it just didn't make sense. If there were lots of community transmissions, if we were doing it to protect newborn babies and mothers, and they outlined the risks to me, it would make sense. But there was one person who had COVID at the time. There was no community transmissions and everything had opened again and everything was functioning normal apart from wearing face masks in public. But for some reason, no one thought to change the rules for hospitals and how much that could affect a woman's birthing experience and their mental health. It's still confusing to me.
It's pretty rough that you were then sort of forced to stay there essentially on your own. And then were you given any sort of indication that your husband could come back in, or was there any communication about that?
No, it was just the same thing, like, yep, when you're in active labour. And I remember saying a few things like, oh, are there any birth suites free? Because once in a birth suite, they can come in, which I don't understand the difference. You get off a lift and you go into these tiny rooms. You get off a lift and you go into these bigger rooms. You can wear a face mask in between. You can sign in. Is there a birth suite open? Is there any way I can get in? Or can you come a bit early? Or, nothing. The midwives were lovely, but they also, I got the sense that they couldn't talk about it and they couldn't voice their opinions. Like, they listened, but they couldn't really effectively communicate with me what a solution, what they thought, or communicate with me solutions, you know.
They were sort of taking the approach of our arms are tied and there's nothing else we can do.
Which I understand, but at the same time they were all I had at the time, and I couldn't really be like, this sucks, help me. And I just tried to stay positive that night. I really just kept my focus on the morning and hoping that things would change in the morning. I just felt like I had to get through that night. And I just kind of knew that the way my body felt, the stress I felt and the loneliness I felt would mean that I wouldn't go into labour. Like, I told Josh to go to sleep. My student midwife could have come in. They were accepted. That was one rule that was changed, is that student midwives who were considered medical staff could attend. So I think she may have been able to come in that night, but I just knew that nothing was going to happen without Josh there. And so I told her to sleep. I told him to sleep, and I told them that I'll talk to them in the morning. In the morning, an obstetrician came, the one that I'd seen in my clinic appointments, which was good that I was familiar with her, and she knew how much I wanted a VBAC, and she was very pro VBAC in the times that I met with her. And she said that she gave me my choices. I think they did an examination and said, nope, you're not dilated. I'm like, yep, I kind of knew that. Nothing's been happening. And she said, you can either stay in here for another 12 hours by yourself, because you need on the drip, because that's how long we're happy to keep the drip running on you. That's the antibiotics for the group B. Or you can go to the birth suite and get the Syntocin drip. Now, I didn't really want the Syntocin drip along with being induced in my original, you know, birth map. That was something I'd consider but wasn't keen on. But at that point in time, I figured I hadn't been induced. I'd had the spontaneous labour that I wanted. There'd been no interventions yet except for, you know, COVID impacting Josh being there. So I said yes to that. It seemed like the obvious choice to me, and it's still, looking back, was the obvious choice, because it meant that I could see Josh. I could be in a birthing suite. Things could happen. So I consented to that, went to the birthing suite, and my midwife, gorgeous midwife Georgie, showed up, and she was all positive after having a good night's sleep. And had a shower, which was a great shower after feeling gross all night, and put on my birthing outfit that I wanted to wear. And Josh showed up and he brought heaps of snacks and he brought the speaker and started playing my favourite music, which usually he complains about at home, but this is my birth, so I got to listen to my lame music and he wasn't allowed to complain. And I had two other midwives arrived, and they were like two of the best women that I think I met along my whole birth journey. I really wanted to have the wireless monitoring, and I knew that it can be problematic, but they gave it a go, and it was like a comic. It was really comical watching them all try to do it together. It was really funny, and I enjoyed that. Then, I was like, so are we going to get this? And I had some contractions, and then I said, are we going to get the Syntocin drip? And they're like, you don't need the Syntocin drip. You're contracting really frequently. So obviously my body started releasing all the happy hormones and I didn't feel stressed anymore. And I never needed the drip. I started laboring again all by myself.
Could you feel the contractions?
Yeah, and I loved it.
Because it's obviously very different to Kai's birth, you know, where you didn't actually get to that stage where you were experiencing spontaneous contractions and spontaneous labor.
Yeah, I loved it. Every contraction, I used the breathing techniques that I learned in Pilates and in that course I did. And I use a lot of horse breath, which I really like for examinations and for some contractions. And I got Josh to hold onto my back and squeeze like on the side, which was really helpful. I held onto him. I got on the birthing ball quite a bit, which really helped, I think, helped engage your head. And because I felt really strong contractions then. And I just really enjoyed being in that room. I remember someone saying to me at that birth course about contractions and how to deal with them, and that really stuck with me, was that they're not forever. They'll be over soon. You get a break in between. So, yeah, that went on for most of the morning and early afternoon. But I did notice on the screen that her heart rate was sitting a little bit above where they want it to be. And I did notice that it was slowly rising. And I could see the midwives looking at it and kind of chatting quietly. But I ignored it. I didn't want to focus on that. They showed concern, maybe not towards me, but I could pick up on the concern that whenever I had a contraction, her heart rate would drop, which I didn't know was a good thing or a bad thing or a normal thing. And at about, I remember saying to Josh, I wanted to lay down for a moment. My body just felt like it needed to lay down. I said to Josh, I feel like either I'm going to have this baby, it's going to be a long process, or I'm going to have a C-section in a couple of hours. And then just as I finished saying that, a doctor walked in with full scrubs, walked in and said to me, you know, we've noticed that your baby's heart rate's been rising and has been falling after contractions. And that unfortunately can be a sign of infection. So it wasn't the news I wanted to hear, but at the same time, it wasn't a big shock to my system. It was something I'd mentally prepared for. It was something I'd already experienced. I'd already had a C-section, so I kind of knew what to expect. Even though I wanted a vaginal birth, I think a little bit of me was like, okay, at least I know what's going to happen next. With a vaginal birth, I hadn't experienced pushing a baby out before. So even though I was really wanting to do it, it was kind of like a, you know, at least I know what's happening. So I said that I wanted a moment to think about it, even though I'd already made the decision to do what I thought was best for the baby. So they came back in a few minutes and I just talked to Josh and just kind of said, well, you know, this has been quite a ride and I had my spontaneous labor and I've had a really great positive day in here. And yeah, made the decision to sign the consent and have a C-section.
And how long did it take you from that moment to getting to theatre, and how are you feeling in that time?
Well, I feel like crying now, so I think I felt pretty emotional. I think one layer of me was like I said before, like at least I know what to do and I'm prepared, but I think another part of me was really disappointed and sad. So it was probably that mix of emotions, but I wasn't super upset. I wasn't shocked. I was okay. What was really unfortunate though is that by the time I made the decision, someone else, an emergency C-section, had gone through, which is probably a positive for that person. They needed the place. They were in the theatre for quite a long time, so they took their time with me preparing me for surgery, which meant I didn't realise until it started happening is that I was going to continue having the contractions until I got the epidural outside the theatre. So those contractions, those contractions weren't the positive contractions I was experiencing. I've been ill before. Those contractions sucked.
I had that too, Erin.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So awful, isn't
it? It feels so wrong because you just
so wrong.
Think I've made the decision now, or we've made the decision, we're going into surgery, and they're the most intensive, obviously, because they're a lot more, you're a lot more progressed.
Yeah.
And it's a really intense pain, and you're just sort of waiting.
You just want it to be over, don't you? You're like, this is fair. This is.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a bit... like, yeah, body, do your thing. Yeah. Push that baby down. And now you're like, no, I've opted out. Stop.
Yeah, that's right. And when you did make that decision, did you feel as though you were supported
either way by everyone that was in the room? I mean, was anyone sort of saying to you, look, I really think it's best for you to go down the repeat cesarean route? Or was anyone saying, no, I think you should press on and try and continue? What was the consensus? The
consensus was that I'd done awesomely that day and overcame a not so ideal night the night before. So there was a lot of positivity in the room and I felt very supported and listened to. Well, and I don't think anyone put their opinion on me. I think when I said, I think I want to do what's right by the baby. If there's an infection, I don't want to risk my baby's health. And they're like, yep, that's a great decision. Yeah, I didn't feel any conflict at all.
And ultimately, you felt as though that decision was yours. It wasn't sort of taken from you or coerced in any way.
Not at all. And I asked more questions this time. I said, well, what are the, this infection, how sure are you that it's an infection and what could the infection be? Yeah, I feel like I asked the right questions and I felt like, the decision was all mine.
Did you want to take us through what happened in theatre then and how you felt that compared to the first time around, if there were any differences?
It actually went worse than the first time.
Really? Oh, was it?
Because of the infection worry, I suppose. Did baby get taken away?
No, baby wasn't taken away, but I was in there for 2 hours, which is a long time.
Oh.
The things that happened included. I ended up because I met with the anaesthetist and they decided to do a spinal this time. And that went in just fine. But then the spinal went a bit too high and I felt like I couldn't breathe for a little bit there, which I think I've heard a few women say that happened.
I've heard of this happening.
Yeah, they didn't seem too stressed by it. They just kind of, I think they elevated me a little bit and they put a breathing mask on me, which I don't know if that was just good for me feeling like, yes, this is helping me breathe, or if it was actually doing anything. But that happened, which was, dealable. The anaesthetist, I'm glad I've learned how to say it properly. I've said it so many times.
doing well.
He was hilarious. I feel like a lot of women say that the anaesthetist is, they're usually quite funny characters who aren't as serious as the other doctors. Like, he was really chatty, but he was really obsessed with my blood sugar, like really obsessed to a point that I was like, mate, I've got this.
I've had it all my life. It's okay.
Yeah, he's like, your blood sugar is 5.0. It might go to 4, which is dangerous. I'm like, or it could just stay at 5. So he was really insistent on like giving me some glucose by the drip. And I was like, okay, you do you. If it makes you happier and I get a bit higher, that's okay. And then it started to drop a little bit more later and he got all stressed and I was like, well, just give me some glucose. Like, I feel fine. Like, diabetes is not a concern right now. Yeah. I feel like you're in a good place if your blood sugar goes low. They've got glucose just there that they can put into your body. It's fine. But he was very entertaining. It was taking a long time, like a really long time. And I didn't know what was happening. But after a while, I started to get really dizzy and feel really, cold. I thought I was really cold or really hot, one of the two. Did not feel well, felt like I was going to vomit. And it turns out, my blood pressure was dropping. I was aware of that. And I remember my student midwife, lovely Georgie, she kind of popped her head over the curtain and then looked at me. And thankfully her face mask may not have given away her facial expression as much as it would have otherwise, but her eyes comforted me somehow. And she said, yeah. I said, is everything okay? She's like, yeah, babe, you're fine. I was like, oh, good. Turns out that I'd lost a liter of blood because when they cut me open, they cut a blood vessel connected to my uterus. I say that in a high-pitched voice because I'm not 100% sure, but they cut something that they shouldn't have and apparently they had to cinch it together with their hands while they stitched it up. And I lost blood as a result, which made me feel unwell, but it was resolved pretty quickly. And then at the end, then she came out and that was awesome. And I felt more connected to her than I did with Kai. I really, really wanted her on me straight away. Like, I was like, give her to me. And the moment I saw her, the name Neve was one of the names I wanted. I was like, yep, this is Neve. And she was on me and she couldn't quite feed yet, I think because they had curtain was up too far. And then I started getting the shakes, like the crazy shakes that I know happens to a lot of women as well. I just say, I can't have her on me right now. I'm shaking so much. So Josh took her. I think because I, you know, read so much and listened to many stories, I just knew that all these things that could happen in C-section can happen. So nothing really hugely scared me, because I knew it wouldn't be forever. I knew it would go away, you know. But I was in there, yeah, quite a while, them stitching me up. And then in recovery, I got to hold her. We got to breastfeed. And just like Kai, she did the crawl up and she found the breast really easily. So two big things happened in recovery. The first thing was that the doctor came in, like the head obstetrician that was in there came in and told us all these things that had happened. I described in too much detail what when he cut me open, how he, you know, cut something he shouldn't have, and how I'd lost lots of blood and a couple of other things. I think a few. Apparently, it was quite hard. I apparently had a boggy uterus.
Okay.
Which I googled and still don't understand what it means. Something to do with the uterus just wasn't the texture it's supposed to be, which could have been caused by an infection that they thought that was causing her heart rate to be elevated. But they weren't completely sure. Oh, I should probably throw in there that she was 4.5 kilos.
Yeah.
Oh,
so
wow.
That's what I was wondering actually. So did she match the predictions from the scans?
Yeah, she did. Kind of thinking for very low fours, like, you know, 4.2. But, you know, getting up to close to 5.
Yeah.
Gave me, you know, a little bit of happiness that she didn't come out of my vagina. Bit of focus on the positives.
Was there any discussion, Erin, of what had caused Neve's distress when you were in labour?
I kept asking and there was no absolute conclusion. They suspected a few things, like the boggy uterus. There was no definitive answer, and I am planning on getting her birth notes, but yeah, there was nothing else that really indicated what her distress was caused by. Would like an answer on that. Josh, sorry. This is something we were aware of, but it was still a shock. He was asked to leave straight after the birth.
Really?
Yep. What? So they made out to us like they were doing us a favour by letting him stay in recovery for like about 10 to 15 minutes. Apparently they had a shortage that night, which is why they're moving people through quicker than usual. And my midwife advocated for me and said, don't use your shortage as an excuse. Like, he already won't be able to return. Let's make sure that he at least gets to hold his daughter, have some skin on skin time. So they said yes, and he stayed for 15 minutes. And then security came to ask him to leave. And yeah, we had to say goodbye, which isn't good. Say goodbye to your baby 15 minutes after they're born.
Yeah, particularly, yeah, for you as well. I mean, did that feel?
Well, I feel like I was okay because I knew that that was going to happen. You know, over the course of that night, I knew what the restrictions meant for this hospital. It wasn't a shock like the night before. What I was most sad about was that he wouldn't be able to bond with Neve like he did with Kaya, and he wouldn't be able to sit and hold her and just have that time to get to know her and stare at her face like every parent deserves to do those first few hours and those first few days in hospital. So he just missed out on that, and Neve missed out on that, and that wasn't fair, and it didn't make sense either.
Kelly, as you were saying, football matches are going ahead and maternity was just left behind.
Yeah, we're totally left behind. It made zero sense. I also learnt that if she had a low blood sugar or had any other issues that would mean that she went to NICU, that Josh would be allowed to visit there, and therefore I could go down there too, you know, go in a wheelchair to go visit her, to be with her, which makes no sense to me on another level, because isn't that where the babies who are the most immune compromised are? Dads are allowed to go there, but dads aren't allowed to go up a lift, down one hallway with a face mask on and into a room to care for their partner who's just birthed or had major surgery and bond and care for their new child. It just, yeah, blew my mind how left behind we were. And I consider myself quite a resilient, positive person, but there would have been so many women who had an absolute traumatic experience or their first birth or gone into labour, you know, and had a premature baby, or, you know, so many different things could happen in hospitals, and so many women were left to care for their babies by themselves while recovering, and that the emotional damage that would have done to women is just something that you can never really, you know, completely recover from.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
You're very strong, and I know you shared with us that you even spoke to the media about your experience.
Yeah, I did.
So thank you for doing that, because you know, again, you're doing that using your agency and your whole experience. You've been on a journey with two births now, but like you said, a first-time mum, you know, might not even know what had happened to her. It's just not fair, and I hope that your story will actually serve as proof as to what should be done in these snap lockdowns and what shouldn't be done, because obviously they're still continuing. Like as we talk to you now, Melbourne are back in lockdown for a week, but it seems to be that the go-to is, okay, we're going to immediately affect support people in the birthing room, and in your case in Perth with one positive case and no community or suspected community transmissions, but not really nothing concise. Your husband missed out on parts of the birth.
I forgot to mention that one of my best friends, who I've been close to for a very long time, she came to appointments with me and was going to be act like a doula for me, because she is one of those people that can read my facial expressions and can see what I need. So throughout the whole pregnancy, I had a real team created for the birth experience, that the most positive birth experience I could have. So the fact that she couldn't come as well was disappointing. And I'm just so relieved that I had my student midwife and that she was allowed. So I don't know what I would have done without having her on my side as well.
How did your husband feel? Did he talk to you about it?
He's a pretty strong person and likes to, you know, think about what you can do instead of what you can't do. But I do think that it has impacted him not being able to spend that time with us in hospital and not being able to look after me in hospital, because that's what, you know, that's a partner's job, a partner's role when a woman gives birth, is to make sure that I was warm, make sure that I had food, make sure that I had water, you know, change the baby's nappy. So I think that he felt really like he couldn't.
Powerless, sort of, in a way.
Yeah, powerless, that's the word. Yeah,
or helpless, or unable to help you or assist you.
Yeah, just so distant from a big thing that's happening to people he loves and cares about. He did, not in his true fashion, he did focus on the fact that he got to spend one-on-one time with our son during that time, because it was a big change for him with us bringing a new baby home. So he got that time to connect with him. So, yeah, he was positive, but also it's still not fair.
So, Erin, you've kind of sort of told us about, I guess, the differences between the two births. Do you want to take us through to maybe your postpartum period and how things were? Did you stay in hospital for a few days, similar to last time? And
I actually discharged myself early because I wanted to get home. I actually had quite a positive experience in hospital, considering what had happened and that Josh wasn't there. Because of losing blood, they sent me to special care ward, where I got one-to-one care with a midwife, and she was brilliant. She listened to me, and I think she understood that not having my partner there meant that I needed someone to kind of mother me to a point. And she showered me the next day and made me feel really comfortable, and I got a really nice big room there as well. And my midwife, she stayed until really late that night as well, and then my friend who works there came and visited me, and I was able to debrief with her. And the next day, another friend who's a midwife came and debriefed as well and brought me things. So I was quite looked after. That was the first night. The next night I got sent to the normal ward, and that was the same ward I was on having Kai. And I was just like, I don't want to be here. Like, I want to be at home. I want Josh to be able to hold her. I want to see Kai. And I felt fine-ish considering I just had surgery. But the pain was really different this time. Like, even when the pain medication wore off, it wasn't that intense unless I was, you know, doing something, moving awkwardly. And Neve was feeding really well, and I felt mentally really well. I think the whole experience, even with some of the things that happened due to COVID and the Group B strep, I still felt positive. I still felt looked after. I still felt like I made choices that I wanted to make, and that I felt empowered by the knowledge that I had behind me and the support that system that I'd created. And I went and saw the movie Birth Time and spoke to one of the women who created that and asked her questions. Like, I just felt really excited about what could happen instead of scared.
That's great.
So even when I faced the challenges, I still was able to feel overall positive somehow. Yeah. So based on those feelings, I felt really confident in going home and confident in the care that I'd have at home as well. Like my friend had organized a meal train for us. I'd organized the house to be cleaned. I had already told people that I didn't want lots of visitors and I'd be in touch with them about when I wanted visitors, because last time I felt really overwhelmed by people coming over and wanting to hold the baby and wanting a cup of tea. This time I made the decision that if you come over, it's because you're invited and you bring something or you empty my dishwasher.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
And it's worked. It's worked mostly with most people. I'm quite a direct person and pretty into my boundaries. So I found that, you know, most people respected those wishes. And, yeah, being at home, having Josh home, being with Kai meeting me for the first time was just beautiful. He's so beautiful with her in general. It was really, really nice this time.
What did you think of birth time? We
loved it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everyone who is interested in birth, going to give birth, has given birth, should see it. It really was, I learned a lot about how many women are traumatized by the birth experience and what's done throughout Australia and what needs to change. And I had no idea about before, you know, before this experience, that how some women are just so disadvantaged and get, you know, the cascade of interventions put on them and don't get that postnatal care that they deserve. And I've completely changed my opinion on home births as well. Like a few years ago, I'd been like, why would you do a home birth? Have a home birth, you hippie, like go to hospital where there's doctors that can save your life. Now I'd love a home birth. Like what a dream.
Yeah, it's amazing how it changes your outlook.
Sharing stories.
Yeah.
Like what you guys do and what they did in that in birth time was just about sharing experiences and sharing stories that we can all learn from that can shape the future of birth, isn't it? If we all learn what we have gone for and what we deserve, and eventually hopefully things can change for the better.
Hopefully, you know, you touched on this too, Erin, about as a type 1 diabetic, you were not able to be on a continuity midwifery program. It would be nice, and that's one of the major themes in birth time, is one woman, one midwife. Would you like to see a midwife led care even for a type 1 diabetic?
Yes.
Yeah. I think it's almost like the high risk or considered high risk because it's so subjective. They need it the most, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's how I kind of feel.
Definitely. And I felt like even though there were midwives at the clinic, how beneficial it would have been if even if I saw a different doctor every week, that I could deal with. But if I then had the same midwife to kind of debrief and say, well, he said this, I'm not sure what that means. Or now I'm thinking I might, you know, try vaginal birth because of this. What do you think? If I just had someone to discuss things and discuss my options and I could sit there and make notes and go home and then reflect with my partner, I felt like just that extra medical person on board that knew me from the start to the end at those clinic appointments would have been very beneficial.
In terms of advice to other women that might find themselves in a similar circumstance to yours, would you have any advice to give to them?
I think if women are already listening to your podcast, then they're already doing a huge favour to themselves. They've already opened the door to information that's out there, and to keep finding information that is connected to what you want. And I found it really helpful to just keep a note, like in the notes in my phone, whenever I learnt something or thought of something, or, you know, I ran into a midwife I know at a dinner party and they started talking about something, I'd, you know, make a quick note about it. And then like every week or two, I'd kind of open those notes and transfer them to a Word document. So it was like a running Word document. And then towards the end of my pregnancy, I printed it out and, you know, took it to my doctor, asked questions, and then I turned it into more of a map about everything that I knew, everything that was important to me. So it was really like a visual guide for me that brought together everything that was important and everything that I'd learned, so that when I went to hospital, no matter what happened, I could go, yeah, I actually did read about that, that I'm going to make an educated decision on this.
Definitely good advice, particularly the second time around, no matter what happens, I think, yeah.
I think some women go into the birth experience being like, whatever happens, happens. And sometimes that works out really well. Like they go in, they get the epidural, they feel great, they give birth 9 hours later, they have a tear, they stitch it up, they go home. You know, and that's a comment that can happen. But then other times you go in and you're faced with, you can have a C-section or you can continue the induction. You can keep struggling with breastfeeding, or we can give your baby formula. There's so many, you know, decisions that you need to make. And if you've dedicated some time to it, I think it can really empower your experience and make it a positive one, even with challenges.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely.
We wanted to say thank you so much, Erin, for sharing this story and for willing to talk to us so early as well, postpartum wise. You know, you've got a 4-week old little Niamh, and it's been such a pleasure talking to you and hearing your story and your important messages to women and also just to maternity care providers, the government, politicians, anyone who's making policies around hospitals, and hearing your experience, your lived experience, I think goes a long way.
There was a post that Evidence-Based Birth had shared, and we had shared it to our stories, that said lived experience is evidence. I thought that was quite significant.
You know, because a lot of times you just read these studies and there's people obviously that it's based on, but so often you read the studies and you don't think about the emotional effects and what can transpire from various statistics, I guess, put together. But here are like a collection of women's stories, and there a lot of them have similarities, and it really does.
You start to see patterns.
Start to see patterns. That should be enough to change policies, to be honest.
Like I said, stories should really be enough, shouldn't they?
Yeah, women's
politicians to listen to enough stories, and hopefully they don't, you know, allow that to happen again.
100%, Erin. Well, thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thanks for sharing your story.
Thank you for listening to this VBAC story. If you like the show, please subscribe and feel free to leave a review. If you would like to connect with us on social media, you can find us on Instagram and Facebook. Just search for VBAC Birth Stories. If you have a question or you'd like to express interest in sharing your personal story, email us at vbacbirthstories@gmail.com. VBAC Birth Stories is a podcast where we share women's lived experiences. Please be advised that it's not intended to replace medical advice. If you have any concerns at all during your pregnancy, please always speak to your healthcare provider.